Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the one and only Sean Sports Talk Podcast. This is a milestone episode. This is episode number 420. For those of you fellow weed smokers out there, this is a big one, number 420, very symbolic, obviously. And we're going to get right into it. We're going to get right into it because we have a lot to talk about. The NFL season is rapidly approaching the playoffs. The MLB offseason, the hot stove, is seemingly in full swing. The winter meetings are just about to get underway. Today is Monday morning right now, 9:40 a.m. Pacific time, to be specific. I'm coming at you from, as always, the usual spot, Los Angeles, California. So we got that. We got the NBA. We got the return of a tennis legend. We got hockey. There's lots to talk about. So with all of that said, with all of that acknowledged, let's get right into it, starting with, you guessed it, some NFL. The Buffalo Bills blew a late lead for the third time in six games on Sunday. That was enough to allow the Philadelphia Eagles to win in overtime, but two NFL sources told The Athletic's Tim Graham there was zero chance that it was enough to cause the midseason firing of head coach Sean McDermott. Four sources with, quote, intimate knowledge of the relationship between McDermott and Bills owner Terry Pegula. Side note, Terry Pegula's daughter is the highest ranked female American tennis player in the world. She is sensational. But anyway, four sources with intimate knowledge of the relationship between McDermott and Bills owner Terry Pegula said the team had no plans to change coaches. The 6-6 Bills are in danger of not winning the AFC East for the first time in four seasons, as the 8-3 Miami Dolphins extend their division lead. After two consecutive seasons of regular season success and postseason disappointment for the Bills, they're now number 10 in the AFC, and they're in danger of missing the playoffs altogether. So they're in danger of not even getting to the postseason disappointment stage. The team has a 14% chance only of making the playoffs, according to the New York Times. Those odds are definitely disappointing. Definitely a disappointing result for the Bills' first season since signing McDermott and general manager Brandon Bean two extensions through 2027 in June. The pair had previously been signed with the team through 2025. Although the signing was a public show of confidence in the Bills' current front office, NFL teams have extended coaches and then shortly after parted ways in the past. The Arizona Cardinals moved on from former head coach Cliff Kingsbury in January, 10 months after extending him through 2027. That's pretty surreal. That is not likely to happen this season in Buffalo, according to the NFL sources, who said Pegula wants to maintain, quote, the strong working bond between McDermott and Bean, per Graham. And rightfully so. I mean, McDermott holds a 68-41 regular season record and 9-4 postseason record during his seven seasons as the Bills head coach. Heading into 2023, he had led the Bills to four consecutive 10-win seasons. But McDermott's Bills have yet to get past the AFC Championship, where the 2020 team lost to the Kansas City Chiefs. McDermott said after the loss to the Eagles that the team's playoff goals were, quote, still within our reach, per BuffaloBills.com's Alec White. The final five games of the season will determine how true that really is. But the Bills are in a bad spot, definitely in a tough spot this season. I definitely don't think that they should fire their head coach. They've had, you know, immense regular season success, and there were times where they should have beat the Chiefs and made the Super Bowl. I don't know if I would call it them choking, getting unlucky, Mahomes getting lucky, Mahomes being clutch with the Chiefs, or perhaps it's a mix of all of the above. But we got some more football to talk about. Dak Prescott continued his recent strong play on Thursday Night Football as the Dallas Cowboys defeated the Seattle Seahawks in a shootout by the final score of 41-35. Dak Prescott finished with 299 yards, completing 71% of his passes while throwing three touchdowns and recording zero turnovers. That is the huge part. He's now thrown multiple touchdown passes with no interceptions in four of his last five starts. The 30-year-old also added 22 yards on the ground. The Cowboys trailed 35-27 early in the fourth quarter, although Prescott helped engineer three straight scoring drives to give Dallas a six-point lead that it would not relinquish for the rest of the night. Both offenses were outstanding during the game, although the Cowboys were slightly better to pull out the win. NFL fans were in awe of Dak's stellar performance during the high-scoring affair, with some calling for him to be named MVP. Since week eight, four touchdowns, one interception. Week 9, three touchdowns, zero interceptions. Week 10, four touchdowns, one interception. Week 11, two touchdowns, zero interceptions. Week 12, 4 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. Week 13, 3 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. So since week 8, Dak Prescott has thrown for 20 touchdowns and only 2 interceptions. That is elite. That is MVP caliber right there. He is the first quarterback since 2020 to have 6 straight games with at least 2 passing touchdowns in each game and a total of at least 20 passing touchdowns. So very impressive stuff from Dak Prescott. CeeDee Lamb was obviously Dak Prescott's top target, hauling in 12 receptions for 116 yards and a touchdown. Tight end Jake Ferguson recorded 6 catches for 77 yards of his own, the second highest total of his career. This included a 12-yard touchdown grab to give Dallas a late lead. The Cowboys moved to 9-3 after the victory, as head coach Mike McCarthy's team currently owns the top wildcard spot in the NFC by a wide margin. They are obviously not leading their division, as they are still behind the Philadelphia Eagles, who we will talk about soon. But first, I want to talk about a few NFL trades that I think could potentially go down and would be beneficial for a lot of people. Since the NFL trade deadline has passed, teams are limited to the free agent market for potential reinforcements. What if that wasn't the case, though? Division races and wildcard chases are heating up around the league, but key injuries are starting to plague rosters. Meanwhile, non-contenders are beginning to eye the offseason, where notable contributors will hit free agency and may leave for nothing in return. Very serious football analysis is happening all over, and we got you covered here at Sean Sportstop, of course. For a moment, however, let's dream up some hypotheticals and envision how a handful of trades could change the final 6 weeks of the season. Each player included is an impending free agent who would join a contender. First off, we got Mike Unwenu to the Texans. The Houston Texans are one of the biggest surprises of the 2023 season. They have surged to a 6-5 record and firmly sit in the AFC wildcard hunt. But they just received some bad news. Left guard Titus Howard is expected to miss the rest of the season because of a knee injury, per NFL Network. That's yet another hit to Houston's already decimated offensive line. Juice Scruggs, a 2023 second-round pick, is the likely replacement for Howard. Meanwhile, the 2-9 New England Patriots are spiraling toward the worst record in the AFC. Who would have thought that that would be the case for the Patriots several years ago? If allowed, Mike Unwenu would be an excellent trade ship. The versatile lineman is the Patriots' right tackle, but he started at right guard in 2022 and previously aligned at left guard as well. New England would avoid seeing him possibly sign elsewhere in March, while the Texans could immediately improve the protection in front of breakout rookie quarterback C.J. Stroud. Next up, we got Jalen Johnson to the Saints. It seems unlikely as of now that Jalen Johnson will return to the Chicago Bears. He requested a trade before the deadline, and the Bears allowed him to seek a move, although they did not end up dealing him. 1 month ago, the New Orleans Saints did not have a major need at corner. That changed less than 2 weeks later. Star cornerback Marshon Lattimore exited the Week 10 loss to the Minnesota Vikings with an ankle injury. New Orleans recently placed him on injured reserve, so Lattimore cannot return until Week 16 at the earliest. In the wide-open NFC South, the 5-6 Saints, who are tied with the Atlanta Falcons for first place in the division, still have a path to the playoffs. Adding Johnson would not guarantee an NFC South crown for the Saints, but he'd bolster a secondary that is missing its top corner. Next up, number 3, Brian Burns to the Dolphins. Miami Dolphins linebacker Jalen Phillips missed a few games earlier in the season, but he was otherwise been fulfilling the expectations of a breakout season. After returning in mid-October, the third-year edge rusher had notched a sack in 5 straight games. However, Phillips tore his right Achilles during Miami's win over the New York Jets on Black Friday, and obviously he's going to miss the rest of the season. In his place, the Dolphins signed veteran Jason Pierre-Paul. Wouldn't it be great if they could have landed Brian Burns, though? Burns is due for a new contract this offseason, and negotiations with the Carolina Panthers seemingly have not progressed. The Panthers could franchise tag him, but players typically do not like playing without a long-term contract. Carolina reportedly rebuffed offers for Burns at the deadline. In a hypothetical world, however, the Dolphins could reinforce their defense while the Panthers fully commit to their rebuild. Derrick Henry to the Cowboys. Can you imagine Derrick Henry as a change of pace option? That's a real Madden-level roster situation. While the 4-7 Tennessee Titans drift toward missing the playoffs, the soon-to-be 30-year-old is also approaching free agency. His contract voids following the season, and the Titans probably should move in a new direction. After all, they drafted fellow running back Tyjae Spears with a third-round pick this past spring. Henry remains effective, however, and the Dallas Cowboys could use a half-season jolt. Henry's greatest value is definitely his strength. Tony Pollard is no doubt a quality back, but he is not the short yardage and red zone powerhouse that Henry has always been. Throw in Henry's strong pass-blocking value, and Dallas would add another element to their diverse, productive offense. And lastly, Mike Evans to the Baltimore Ravens. On the bright side, the Baltimore Ravens appear to finally have landed a long-term receiver with rookie Zay Flowers. Lamar Jackson still needs more help, though, especially now that his favorite target, veteran tight end Mark Andrews, will be sidelined for at least the next few weeks due to an ankle injury. Mike Evans you would have a call on line one. Prior to the season, Evans' representation gave the Tampa Bay Buccaneers a deadline for a contract extension. The two sides obviously never reached an agreement, so Evans will be a free agent in March and could leave the team. Baltimore currently leads the AFC at 9-3, but we've seen this movie before. Basically, every year the Ravens' offense has stumbled in the playoffs. Part of that lands on Lamar Jackson, but part of that falls on the supporting cast and lack of wide receiver help as well. Evans, who ranks second in the league with 9 touchdown catches, would instantly be Baltimore's much-needed top wide receiver. So those are some hypothetical trades. Let's see, what do we got next? We got some tennis to talk about next. This is not something that is talked about often on this show, but this is big. After missing virtually all of 2023 due to a hip injury, Rafael Nadal has announced his return to the tennis court. The 22-time Grand Slam tournament champion said in a video that he will be playing the Brisbane International in January, leading up to the Australian Open Grand Slam. Nadal's only Grand Slam tournament this year was the Australian Open in January, where he was the defending champion. He was upset in the second round by Mackenzie McDonald, shout out him, who's from, he went to UCLA, in straight sets. A hip injury was bothering Nadal during the match, to the point that he had to receive treatment during a medical timeout. Quote, "It's a tough moment, it's a tough day," Nadal said after losing the match. "I can't say that I am not destroyed mentally at this moment because I would be lying." Heartbreaking stuff there, considering how nice of a guy and how much of a class act Rafael Nadal is. There was some hope that Nadal would be able to return in April for the Monte Carlo Masters, but he wound up withdrawing from the event 4 days before it was scheduled to begin. Nadal skipped his esteemed French Open, marking the first time that he didn't play at Roland Garros since 2004. He also sat out the grass court season, including Wimbledon and the US Open, and dropped out of the top 100 in the world rankings in June. When he announced that his withdrawal from the French Open, Nadal also said 2024 will, quote, probably be his final season on the ATP Tour. The Brisbane International will be played at the Queensland Tennis Centre from December 31st to January 7th. The 2024 Australian Open will begin on January the 14th. Rafael Nadal is a legend. He's definitely a top three tennis player of all time. I would rank him behind Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic simply because most of Nadal's Grand Slams have been the French Open, which is his favorite surface, obviously the clay court that is so prevalent in Spain. Whereas Federer, you know, had a more balanced resume of Grand Slams, winning Wimbledon, you know, several times, the US Open and stuff, winning a couple French Opens as well. But then you have Djokovic, who wins everything. I mean, he has no problem playing on grass, clay, hard court, doesn't matter. So I would rank Nadal behind those two legends for that reason, but they're called the Big Three for a reason. And they're all legends. Let's switch gears to college football now. We got to talk about the playoff. Let's start with the Pac-12. The final Pac-12 championship game was a memorable one. Two of the nation's premier offenses battled it out with a spot in the college football playoff on the line, as number 3 Washington defeated number 5 Oregon by the final score of 34-31 on Friday night. It was also a clash between Heisman Trophy caliber quarterbacks, as the Ducks' Bo Nix and the Huskies' Michael Penix Jr. have been two of the best signal callers in the country this season. Penix Jr. finished with 319 passing yards while completing 69% of his attempts, marking the 9th time this year that he's crossed the 300-yard threshold through the air. He bounced back from a third-quarter interception to throw a touchdown with less than 3 minutes remaining in the game that put Washington up by 10. It wasn't smooth sailing the whole way, however, as the Huskies jumped out to a 17-3 lead in the second quarter before a furious Oregon comeback led to Washington trailing 24-20 near the end of the third. Eventually, Penix Jr.'s heroics helped lead the team to their second victory over Oregon this year. College football fans were impressed. Washington finishes the year 13-0, Pac-12 champions, 2-0 against Oregon and Bo Nix. Bo Nix did have a good game, 239 yards of his own while tossing 3 touchdowns, although Oregon's comeback efforts fell short. He also threw an interception immediately following Penix Jr.'s turnover, which was only his 3rd pick of the season, coming at a horrible time for Bo Nix. Alabama edged out Georgia in the SEC championship. Texas won the Big 12 easily. Michigan destroyed Iowa. So your college football playoff top 4. Number 1, you got the Michigan Wolverines. Number 2, you got the Texas, you got the Washington, so it's Alabama's 4, Michigan, Alabama at the Rose Bowl, and then Washington is going to play Texas in the Sugar Bowl. Florida State, Georgia gets left out, that's whatever, they lost the SEC title game to Alabama, so Bama gets in, that's deserved for them, but Florida State missing out is tough because they went undefeated. They didn't lose a game. They won the ACC championship over Louisville. But they don't have quarterback Jordan Travis, and it would pretty much be a foregone conclusion. It would definitely be a cakewalk for Michigan if they were to play Florida State in the national semifinals. So I do understand why the committee left Florida State out of the playoff. They would get ragdolled by Michigan and essentially, you know, hand them a free ticket to the Natty. But at the same time, how can you leave a team out that went undefeated and won their and won a Power 5 conference? It's never happened before. And, you know, Florida State fans and the players, the university has a right, absolutely, to be fucking infuriated with that. But I do understand where the committee's coming from. Florida State would get absolutely ragdolled by Michigan, whereas Michigan versus Alabama, obviously, is it's a national championship caliber game, except it's in the semifinals. I mean, you know, Alabama, arguably the most successful college football program in history. Perhaps not as dominant as they were a few years ago when they were the perennial number one seed and number one team in the country. But still, if you look at the video of when Michigan found out that they were playing Alabama instead of Florida State, they were not happy, and rightfully so. With that, we got some more college sports to talk about, basketball this time. It was deja vu all over again for top-ranked Purdue after a 92-88 overtime loss to Northwestern on Friday night. This is the second time in 10 months that Purdue has gone to Walsh Ryan Arena as the number one team in the nation and lost. The Wildcats beat their Big Ten rivals 64-58 on February the 12th. The Boilermakers entered the game 7-0 with an average margin of victory of 20.6 points going into their conference opener. That includes wins over Gonzaga, Tennessee, and Marquette, three teams ranked in the top 10 of the current AP poll. Northwestern won 5 of its first 6 games, but it wasn't against the most difficult schedule. Their best win prior to Friday night was against Dayton on November 10th. Purdue looked to be on solid footing early with a 40-32 lead going into halftime. The Wildcats outscored the Boilermakers 44-36 in the second half to force overtime. Boo Booey and Ty Berry combined for 13 of the team's 16 points in overtime for the win. Fans and analysts had some things to say about Zach Edey and the Boilers after their upset loss against Northwestern. Definitely a choke there, but perhaps the most frustrating part of this game for Purdue is that it wasted a fantastic performance from Edey in a loss. The reigning National Player of the Year scored a season-high 35 points and grabbed 15 rebounds. The Boilermakers nearly doubled Northwestern in rebounds 52-27, but the difference was they committed 17 turnovers to only 3 on the other side, so they could not take care of the basketball. The Wildcats shot 10 of 20 from 3-point range, while Purdue made only 26.3% of his attempts. So the combination of Purdue making only 26.3% of their threes and committing 17 turnovers while Northwestern only committed 3 turnovers, that's a recipe for disaster. And even with all of that, it still went to overtime. This is the second time so far this season that the number one team in the nation has gone down. Kansas lost its hold on the top spot in this week's rankings after a 73-59 loss to Marquette on November 21st. Purdue will look to a rebound on Monday when they host Iowa at Mackey Arena. Northwestern, which could move into the top 25 next week for the first time this season, will welcome Detroit Mercy to Walsh Ryan Arena on Sunday. So a huge upset in the world of college basketball. And now we're going to switch gears to the world of the NBA for a little bit. Man, this guy is always in the headlines for the wrong reasons. Memphis Grizzlies superstar guard Ja Morant has been subpoenaed to testify in court regarding a civil lawsuit filed against him. According to ESPN, Morant is being sued by Joshua Holloway, who was 17 years old when Morant allegedly assaulted him during a pickup basketball game at Morant's Memphis home in July 2022. Morant's friend Devontae Pack, as well as his father, mother, and other potential witnesses, were also subpoenaed. Per Baxter Holmes, an immunity hearing is set to take place from December 11th through December 13th, and Morant's lawyers will attempt to get the case thrown out during the hearing by arguing that Morant acted in self-defense after Holloway hit him in the chin with a basketball. A judge issued a stay in the case over the summer when Morant's attorneys tried to get it dismissed under Tennessee's, quote, stand your ground law. If the case goes to trial, it reportedly could begin in April 2024. Morant, who is 24 years old, is currently serving a 25-game NBA suspension after flashing a gun in an Instagram Live video earlier this year. That suspension came after a previous 8-game ban for appearing to flash a gun in an Instagram Live video at a Denver strip club. So this guy really needs to mature fast. After going second overall in the 2019 NBA draft, Morant established himself as one of the league's most explosive young players over the past two seasons, earning a pair of All-Star appearances. Last season, Morant averaged 26.2 points and a career-high 8.1 assists and 5.9 rebounds for a Grizzlies team that went 51-31 and was the number two seed in the Western Conference before falling to the Los Angeles Lakers in the first round of the playoffs. But I thought John Morant was fine in the West. I guess not so much. Obviously, the Grizzlies have struggled mightily without John Morant, going only 5-13, but Morant is first eligible to return from suspension for their December 19th game against the New Orleans Pelicans. So that is pretty soon. The Grizzlies need John Morant like never before. More NBA. Despite his early season struggles and being in the final year of his contract, Klay Thompson will not be traded by the Golden State Warriors. On the Low podcast, ESPN's Zach Lowe said the Warriors, quote, have no desire to trade Thompson. To be clear, the Warriors do not want to trade Klay Thompson. They have no desire to do it. I would bet heavily against it ever happening. The topic came up because in the same episode, Lowe talked about how multiple executives from opposing teams were raising the question. I've had four executives from other teams in the last 72 hours ask me, would they ever trade Klay Thompson? And the reason they're asking is because teams see somewhat of an opportunity there in terms of, can we get involved in a deal? Would they have to attach an asset to trade Klay Thompson if they want to get meaningful win-now talent with multiple years left on their contract in exchange for Klay Thompson? There's been nothing publicly, you know, reported to indicate the Warriors have even thought about moving on from Klay Thompson during the season. The two sides were on different pages regarding a potential extension before the season began. The Athletic reported on October 23rd that the contract talks between Thompson and the Warriors stalled due to both the salary and years on the deal that were being discussed. Klay was seeking more than the Warriors were willing to offer. The five-time All-Star is making $43.2 million this season, the final year of his five-year $189.9 million deal that was signed in July of 2019. After a slow start to the season, Klay looks like he's starting to turn things around. He scored at least 20 points in four of his last five games after failing to hit that mark in each of his first 13. The Warriors are still trying to find positive momentum. They have alternated wins and losses in their last five games and are 9-10 overall. The only time they have won consecutive games was during their five-game winning streak from October 27th to November 3rd. But, you know, no surprise at all that the Warriors don't want to trade Klay Thompson. But we're going to switch gears to some MLB now. Two-way star Shohei Ohtani reportedly may be nearing his decision in MLB free agency. According to Sportsnet, the reigning American League MVP is believed to be entering the, quote, final stretch of negotiations and is expected to meet with a small group of teams in Los Angeles this weekend. Or I guess they already met since it's Monday today. It was noted that while the Los Angeles Dodgers are the favorites to sign Ohtani, the Chicago Cubs, Toronto Blue Jays, Los Angeles Angels, and San Francisco Giants remain in the sweepstakes as well. The field for Ohtani has already been weighted down, as ESPN's Jeff Passan reported this week that the Texas Rangers, New York Mets, and Boston Red Sox turn their attention to other free agents. Ohtani, who is 29 years old, has spent his entire six-year MLB career as a member of the Los Angeles Angels, the poverty franchise. But with the team failing to make the playoffs even once during his tenure, Ohtani is exploring other options that could give him a better chance to win. Even without the playoffs, Ohtani has established himself as the best player in baseball, especially over the past three seasons. The slugging designated hitter and ace starting pitcher was named AL MVP for the first time in 2021 and finished second in 2022 behind only New York Yankees outfielder Aaron Judge, who hit an American League record 62 home runs that season. In 2023, Ohtani had set career marks with a .304 batting average, .412 on base percentage, and .654 slugging percentage. Plus, he led the American League with 44 home runs. And this, mind you, was not over the entire season. 44 home runs, 102 runs scored, 95 RBIs, and 20 stolen bases. And on the mound, he made 23 starts as a pitcher and went 10-5 with a 3.14 ERA, 1.06 whip, and 167 strikeouts over 132 innings. A torn UCL in his throwing elbow eventually ended Ohtani's 2023 season a bit prematurely, and it will prevent Ohtani from pitching in 2024, but he will still be available as a hitter and remains one of the best players in the league, even in that singular role. And he could potentially play the outfield as well, maybe not before he's able to pitch again, but that is a possibility as well. While the torn UCL creates some uncertainty regarding Ohtani's future as a pitcher, he is still expected to land the biggest contract in MLB history. Per Passan, Ohtani is likely to, quote, surge well beyond the $500 million mark with his deal and could approach $600 million with incentives. Ohtani is a franchise-altering player, and he would bring in so much money for whatever team he signs. because of all of Japan, because of it, he's a global superstar, and I hope that the Dodgers sign him. I really do.
As a Dodger fan. Let's talk about Roger Goodell now for a little bit. The most loved commissioner in sports. NFL commissioner Roger Goodell is not a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles' signature short yardage play. Goodell reportedly wants to, quote, permanently ban the Eagles' tush-push play, according to The Athletic. The call typically consists of quarterback Jalen Hurts lining up behind All-Pro center Jason Kelce with two players behind him before snapping the ball and falling forward while the two aforementioned players essentially shove him into the end zone. The play had been deemed legal by the NFL since 2005, as the league removed a stipulation in the rulebook that prohibited offensive players from pushing their teammates in order to gain extra yards. The language that was taken away may be added once again, though. I didn't know that. I thought that it was always illegal, and he just wants to ban it, but I guess it was illegal before 2005 as well. Per the Associated Press, chairman of the NFL's competition committee, Rich McKay, revealed that the league had previously discussed the implementation of the play. Quote, last year we did talk about it a lot. McKay explained in an October interview, there were enough teams to say it's 1 year, let's see it and leave it alone. So we did, and I'm sure it'll be back again, but I just don't want to get in the business of predicting it because I really don't know what the outcome will be. I do know it will be talked about. It's become such an effective play for the Eagles that opponents are openly expecting them to run it, although they're still bewildered when it comes to stopping it. San Francisco 49ers head coach Kyle Shanahan offered his version of a solution ahead of his team's clash with the Eagles, which I will talk about soon. Quote, I know it's possible to stop, but it's proven that it's extremely hard, he said, per NBC Sports Bay Area, so you try to keep them out of those situations. A great mentality from Kyle Shanahan there. You know, he's not calling for it to get banned. He's saying that it's extremely hard to stop, so, you know, you don't want to give them an opportunity to run that play. Keep them out of the end zone. Now we're going to switch gears back to the MLB. The Toronto Blue Jays have, quote, intensified trade talks with the San Diego Padres for star outfielder Juan Soto, according to reporter Hector Gomez. As a result, the Blue Jays are now considered favorites to land Juan Soto after negotiations between the Padres and New York Yankees stalled. San Diego reportedly wanted a package of prospects that the Yankees were not comfortable with giving up. The Padres were asking for pitcher Michael King, pitching prospect Drew Thorpe, and, quote, as many as 4 to 5 other prospects, such Randy Vasquez and Johnny Brito, while also adding the contract of Trent Grisham into the deal. So absolutely ludicrous demands from the Padres, considering the fact that Juan Soto will be a free agent after the 2024 season. San Diego originally acquired Soto via trade themselves in 2022. However, the seemingly dynamic offensive trio of the 3-time All-Star, 2-time Silver Slugger Fernando Tatis Jr., and 6-time All-Star Manny Machado never delivered the postseason success that fans envisioned when they joined the same lineup. They did make the NLCS in 2022, losing to the Philadelphia Phillies. After a disappointing 2023 season that saw the Padres finish with a very mid record of 82-80 and several holes to fill on the roster, Soto is likely to be moved again. Per Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic, he's, quote, almost certain to be traded. Despite the team's poor finish, Soto himself put together another fantastic season. He appeared in all 162 games for the Padres, so he was durable. He had a .275 batting average, hitting 35 home runs and 109 RBIs. He also drew 132 walks, which of course was the highest total in the major leagues. So we will see where Soto will go. Hopefully, it would be very cool to see him on the Yankees, but Blue Jays works. I mean, personally, I wouldn't be surprised if the Padres decide to keep Soto for this season after all. You never know. And they could always trade him at the deadline as well. Let's switch gears back to the NFL. Dak Prescott will reportedly be among the highest-paid quarterbacks in the league on his next contract. He's just going to have to wait for the offseason. On Sunday, NFL Network reported the expectation is that the Dallas Cowboys will come to terms on a long-term extension with the quarterback following this season. Which that contract would place him among the league's highest paid at his position. This comes as no surprise given that recent comments from Cowboys executive vice president Stephen Jones saying, quote, he's under contract now, but we'd like to do this after the season. Once the season is over, we will focus on that. Dak will be our quarterback. While the looming contract is a testament to Prescott's play, there is also a financial element to the eventual move as well. Ian Rappaport pointed out that he is due a $5 million roster bonus on the fifth day of the new league year. What's more, if his contract doesn't change, he will carry a salary cap hit of approximately $60 million in 2024, which would definitely limit the team's flexibility for free agency and other roster moves. That means the contract could come before that roster bonus hits, which would both secure the quarterback's future with the only NFL team that he's ever known and give the front office more opportunity to improve the roster around him. There were some questions about that coming into this season after he led the NFL with 15 interceptions last season, even though he missed 5 games. To his credit, he has responded in impressive fashion by completing 70.1% of his passes for 3,234 yards, 26 touchdowns, to only 6 interceptions. No quarterback has thrown for more touchdowns this year, and his Cowboys are firmly in the playoff picture with a 9-3 record. Dallas will ultimately be defined by how they do in the postseason as they chase their first Super Bowl title since the 1995 season, but Prescott has been among the league's best this season, and it's going to be a matter of simply not choking in the playoffs. Let's talk about the Niners and Eagles game. This was the premier matchup this week. I mean, two of the best teams, two Super Bowl favorites. The highly anticipated matchup in Week 13 between the Philadelphia Eagles and San Francisco 49ers was bound to get a little chippy, but tension certainly escalated in the third quarter. Following a reception from Eagles wide receiver Devontae Smith, Niners linebacker Dre Greenlaw was involved in a sideline altercation with Eagles chief security officer Dom DeSandro. The altercation led to both Greenlaw and DeSandro being ejected from the game. DeSandro is in his 25th season with the Eagles organization and also serves as a senior advisor to the general manager, per the team's website. Niners coach Kyle Shanahan spoke on the situation after the game, saying, quote, "I just can't believe someone not involved in a football game can taunt our players like that and put their hands in our guy's face." NFL senior vice president of officiating Walt Anderson discussed the altercation after the game, saying, quote, "The officials had a flag on the field for a personal foul by San Francisco number 57, and then there was continuing action, and so what Rule 19 allows us to do is provide assistance by looking at the video, and we saw a video that showed that there was a staff person that made contact with the player, and that the player involved number 57 made contact with the staff member, which warranted his disqualification. The non-player, he was contributing to that escalation. Rule 19 does not afford us the ability to help the officials in throwing a flag that they do not throw for a non-player. That's only afforded for a player action." The NFL is reportedly likely to take action against DeSandro for his actions per Pro Football Talk. The incident occurred as the Eagles trailed 21-6, putting them in danger of losing their second game of the season. Beyond this, however, it is the first meeting between the two teams since last season's NFC Championship game, a game that the Eagles won 31-7 after the 49ers experienced bad injury luck at the quarterback position. This matchup could very well be a preview of another future playoff game as both teams look formidable in the NFC. While the Eagles currently have a better record, the head-to-head result could eventually play a role in determining playoff seeding and potential home field advantage in the playoffs. So let's keep talking. The Niners made a huge statement about. They just made a huge statement. They destroyed the Eagles on the road, 42-19. It was all around team dominance as the Niners offense was a scoring machine, getting a touchdown on every single one of their second half drives. Meanwhile, its defense managed to quiet an Eagles offense that has given so many other teams trouble throughout this season. But perhaps the biggest statement of the afternoon was made by quarterback Brock Purdy. Injured on his first drive of that NFC Championship last season, Purdy showed out and perhaps showed why things would have been much different if he was able to go for that entire game. The Niners quarterback passed for 314 yards and threw 4 touchdowns in the win while completing 19 out of 27 passes. Coming into Sunday's matchup, the Eagles were considered the best team in the league by a wide margin, but following this blowout loss, NFL fans believe there should be a new Super Bowl favorite, and they're from San Francisco. I mean, I would agree. As of now, the Niners are definitely the favorite to win the Super Bowl. Next up for the Niners is a divisional matchup against the Seahawks, who they blew out back on Thanksgiving. This was shocking. The Sunday night football matchup, it was shocking. As a Rams fan, it was brutal because the Rams needed the Packers to lose to the Chiefs, which is what everyone expected. And I personally needed the Chiefs to win. I hit 11 out of 12 legs on a 12-leg parlay, and all I needed was the Chiefs to beat the Packers, which was probably the most surefire leg of my 12-leg parlay. And of course, the Packers won. Of course they did. Green Bay Packers quarterback Jordan Love endured a tough stretch in the middle of the season and is now playing like an elite quarterback. Love went toe-to-toe with two-time NFL MVP Patrick Mahomes in primetime and came out on top, throwing 3 touchdown passes to lead Green Bay to a 27-19 win over the reigning Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs at Lambeau Field on Sunday Night Football, like I said, in primetime. It marked the third straight game that Love has thrown multiple touchdowns and with no interceptions. He completed 25 out of his 36 passes for 267 yards in the victory. At one point this season, Love had a run of 5 straight games with an interception. He appears to have learned to keep his mistakes to a minimum, and the Packers' offense has obviously benefited as a result. Love opened the game by leading Green Bay on a 13-play drive capped by a touchdown pass to tight end Ben Sims. His other 2 touchdown passes were reeled in by receiver Christian Watson. So Jordan Love has really turned things around, as have the Packers. I mean, I did not think they would win this game. Love entered the season facing the tough task of filling in the shoes of Aaron Rodgers, who back in the day himself had the tough task of filling in the shoes for Brett Favre. Rodgers was traded to the Jets. The pressure of replacing the four-time MVP appeared to get to him at times, but it now looks like things are finally starting to fall into place for the 25-year-old. Love and the Packers are 6-6 now. They have another primetime matchup in Week 14 when they take on the New York Giants, who are 4-8 on Monday Night Football. Let's see. Let's transition back to the NBA for a little bit. We got to talk about James Harden. James Harden is still making things messy for the Philadelphia 76ers, even after his trade to the Los Angeles Clippers. The 10-time All-Star told The Athletic that Sixers President of Basketball Operations Daryl Morey had verbally committed to offering a max contract. Quote, "Were you actually told by the Sixers that you had that deal coming?" Harden was asked directly, and he said, quote, "Yeah." Harden added that the conversation had occurred before the start of the 2023 playoffs. However, Sam Amick spoke to a source with the Sixers who refuted the claim. Of course they did. This perhaps provides more context for why Harden famously called Morey a liar in the offseason, a moment that made it clear that he was not staying in Philadelphia. He said this in China, actually, saying, quote, "Daryl Morey is a liar and I will never be a part of an organization that he's a part of. Let me say that again. Daryl Morey is a liar and I will never be a part of an organization that he's a part of." Wow. Granted, that would be at odds with the conclusion drawn by the NBA. When announcing the $100,000 fine levied against Harden, the league said Harden's anger stemmed from the fact that the Sixers were not granting his request for a trade. Leaving that aside, emotions clearly remain raw on Harden's side. He told Amick the end of his partnership with Morey, quote, "surprised the hell out of me." He said, quote, "We talked about a lot of shit, and we've got a lot of shit that in front of people's eyes you don't know or understand. But instead of Morey having a conversation with me about free agency or saying, all right, James, we don't want to offer you this, but we have this, then we go back and forth and that's a dialogue, but you just ice me out. Then it's like you don't respect me as much as I thought you did. You don't need people like that. You know what I mean? So it's just bad karma. People were throwing dirt on my name, but the good guys always win." So it sounds like Harden took this whole situation very personally. Harden concluded his interview with Amick by saying he has not conversed with Morey since things broke down between them, citing, quote, "too much money, too much respect that was lost." Assuming the 2017-18 MVP's account and timeline are correct, having a change of heart after the postseason was an understandable, albeit very pragmatic, reaction from the front office's position. Harden averaged 20.3 points and 8.3 assists in 11 games, and he combined to shoot 7 of 27 from the field in Philly's last two losses. And that add that to how his performance more broadly was trending downward, and he's simply no longer a surefire max player. The start to this season has only reinforced that, with the Sixers sitting fourth in the Eastern Conference and the Clippers still under 500 despite his arrival. Fans can argue over whether Morey handled the situation appropriately or not, but at the end of the day, it's a business. So if, you know, yeah, Morey maybe might have made a promise, so, but, you know, he shouldn't stick to his word and compromise his job and what he would believe to be the success of the franchise he works for simply to please James Harden and to honor his word. I mean, like I said, it's a business at the end of the day. And with all of that said, let us now look at the landscape of the... first, let's look at the NFL scores and then the standings and where we stand. We're rapidly approaching the playoffs. As I said. And so we talked about the Thursday night matchup. Cowboys destroy the Eagles. The Indianapolis Colts edged the Tennessee Titans to keep their playoff hopes alive for now, 31-28 in overtime to improve to 7-5, while the Titans fall to 4-8. Gardner Minshew, 26-42, 312 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. Sensational game from Minshew. The running game wasn't really there for the Colts, but Minshew made up for it. Michael Pittman Jr., 11 receptions, 105 yards, and a touchdown. Alec Pierce, 3 receptions for 100 yards and a touchdown. Granson, 3 receptions for 72 yards. For the Titans, Will Levis was serviceable, 16 of 33. That's not very good, but 224 yards and a touchdown, no turnovers. So it's definitely serviceable. Derrick Henry had a huge game, 21 carries for 102 rushing yards and 2 rushing touchdowns. Tyjae Spears, aforementioned, with 16 rushes, 75 yards. DeAndre Hopkins had 5 receptions for 75 yards. So there you have it. Next up, in a horrible game, the Atlanta Falcons edged out the New York Jets 13-8 on the road to improve to 6-6 and keep their playoff hopes alive, while the Jets fall to 4-8 and surely will miss the playoffs, and Aaron Rodgers will surely not play again this season. Desmond Ridder was good enough for the Falcons. 12 of 27, 121 yards and a touchdown. Bijan Robinson, 18 rushes for 53 yards, only 2.9 yards a carry. So a game to forget for him. Kyle Pitts finally had a good game, 4 receptions for 51 yards. Bijan Robinson also had 3 receptions for 26 yards as well. For the Jets, Tim Boyle was not good, 14 of 25, 148 yards, 0 touchdowns and 1 interception. Trevor Siemian came into the game as well, going 5 of 13 for 66 yards, no touchdowns, no interceptions. Dalvin Cook, is still playing, had 9 carries for 35 yards. And Breece Hall was absolutely horrible, 13 carries for 16 yards, only 1.2 yards a carry over 13 carries. Garrett Wilson had 3 receptions for 50 yards, but definitely a game and season to forget for the Jets. The Detroit Lions, who were up 21-0 in the first quarter over the New Orleans Saints, almost blew it, holding on 33-28 on the road to improve to a very impressive and NFC North leading 9-3, while the Saints fall to 5-7. They still could make the playoffs in the abysmal NFC South. But Jared Goff, the Rams legend, went 16 of 25, 213 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. Great game from Goff. Jahmyr Gibbs, 8 rushes for 60 yards. David Montgomery, 18 rushes, 56 yards, and a touchdown. Sam Laporta, I mean, this guy might just be the best rookie tight end of all time. 9 receptions, 140 yards, and a touchdown, averaging 15.6 yards per reception. Amon-Ra St. Brown had a pretty quiet game overall, but still, 2 receptions, 49 yards, and a touchdown, of course. For the Saints, Derek Carr got booed, but he ended up having a pretty good game, actually, going 17 of 22 for 226 yards, a touchdown, and an interception. Jameis Winston went 2 for 5 for 41 yards, and Taysom Hill went 0 for 2 passing. But Taysom Hill had 13 carries for 59 yards and a touchdown. He had more rushing yards than the running back Alvin Kamara, who had 14 carries for 51 yards, but he did have 2 rushing touchdowns. Kamara also had 6 receptions for 58 yards. Chris Olave, 5 receptions, 119 yards, averaging almost 24 yards per reception. And Taysom Hill also had 2 receptions for 15 yards as well. Next up, the Houston Texans ended the Denver Broncos winning streak, edging them out 22-17 at home to improve to 7-5, while the Broncos fall to 6-6. Huge win for the Texans and a pretty big loss for the Broncos, but they were going to lose again at some point. Russell Wilson was horrible. 15 of 26, 186 yards, 1 touchdown, 3 interceptions. Not much on the running game for the Broncos. Cortland Sutton had 2 receptions for 77 yards and a touchdown. Jerry Judy with 3 receptions, 51 yards. For the Texans, C.J. Stroud was great. Again, 16 of 27, 274 yards, a touchdown, no interceptions. Damian Pierce had 15 carries for 41 yards and a rushing touchdown. Devin Singletary had 8 carries for 36 yards, 4.5 yards a carry. C.J. Stroud, the quarterback, also had 6 carries for 11 yards. Nico Collins, holy shit, with Tank Dell going down, breaking his fibula. Prayers up for him. Hopefully he recovers fast out for the season, obviously. Nico Collins, though, 9 receptions, 191 yards, and a touchdown, averaging 21.2 yards per reception. What a game for him. Probably the worst game of the week. The Los Angeles Chargers covered the spread 6-0 on the road in New England. I mean, what a shit game. The Chargers keep their playoff hopes alive, improving to 5-7, while the Patriots fall to an abysmal 2-10. Justin Herbert, fantasy-wise, was mid, 22 of 37, 212 yards, no touchdowns, no interceptions. Austin Eckler had 14 carries for 18 yards. That's 1.3 yards a carry. That is horrible. Justin Herbert had 4 carries for negative 5 yards. Obviously horrible as well. Keenan Allen led the way receiving for the Chargers as he hauled in 5 receptions for 58 yards. Quentin Johnson with 5 receptions for 52 yards. And Gerald Everett, the tight end, 4 receptions for 44 yards. For the Patriots, I mean, Bailey Zappe, 13 of 25, 141 yards. Obviously no touchdowns, no interceptions. Ezekiel Elliott, 17 carries for 52 yards, only 3 yards a carry. And Ramondre Stevenson, 9 carries for 39 yards. So a game and season to forget for the New England Patriots. Here is probably the biggest upset, besides the Packers over the Chiefs, of the week, was the Arizona Cardinals marching into Pittsburgh and taking out the Steelers 24-10 to improve to 3-10, only their third win on the year, while the Steelers fall to 7-5, still in a playoff spot. Kyler Murray, 13 of 23 for 145 yards and a touchdown. James Conner against his former team, what a revenge game for him. 25 carries, 105 rushing yards, 4.2 yards a carry, and 2 rushing touchdowns. McBride led the way for the Cardinals with 89 receiving yards, 8 receptions, averaging, and a touchdown, of course, 11.1 yards per reception. For the Steelers,
Kenny Pickett went down. He was 7 of 10 for 70 yards. Mitch Trubisky took over, and he was actually good. 11 of 17, 117 yards, and a touchdown. Najee Harris, 16 carries, 63 yards. Nothing to write home about. George Pickens was the leading receiver for the Steelers as he hauled in 4 receptions for 86 yards. But Deontay Johnson had 4 receptions for 33 yards and a touchdown. Next up, the Miami Dolphins absolutely raped the Washington Commanders 45-15 on the road to improve to 9-3, while the Commanders fall to 4-9. Tua Tagovailoa was sensational, 18 of 24 for 280 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. Davon Achani, you know, 2 rushing touchdowns, 73 rushing yards. Raheem Mostert added 43 rushing yards, while Jeff Wilson Jr. added 11 rushing yards. Tyreek Hill is the best wide receiver in the world. 5 receptions, 157 yards. That is an average of 31.4 yards per reception. That is unreal. And 2 receiving touchdowns. Jalen Waddle had 5 receptions for 52 yards. So Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill both had 5 receptions, but Tyreek Hill had 105 more yards with the same number of receptions. That is unbelievable. For the Commanders, Sam Howell finally had a bad game as he went 12 of 23 for only 127 yards, 0 touchdowns, and 1 interception. Brian Robinson added 53 rushing yards, and the leading receiver for the Commanders was Curtis Samuel, who had 65 yards over 4 receptions. Terry McLaurin notably had 0 receptions for 0 yards. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers edged out the Carolina Panthers 21-18 at home to still hold on, to still be in the hunt for a playoff spot. They improved to 5-7, while the Panthers fall to an NFL worst 1-11. For the Panthers, Bryce Young went 15 of 31 for 178 yards, 0 touchdowns, and 1 interception. Chuba Hubbard had a heavy workload as he rushed 25 times for 104 yards and 2 rushing touchdowns, so great game for him. Mingo led the way receiving-wise for the Panthers, 6 receptions for 69 yards. DJ Chark Jr. had 3 receptions for 56 yards, while Adam Thielen only had 25 yards over 3 receptions. For the Buccaneers, Baker Mayfield was good enough. Not very good, though, but good enough. 14 of 29, 202 yards, 1 touchdown, 1 interception. Rashad White rushed for 84 yards and a touchdown. Chris Godwin rushed, the wide receiver, had a 19-yard rushing touchdown. Mike Evans, of course, 7 receptions, 162 yards, and a touchdown. Led the way for the Buccaneers. Next up, the Niners and Eagles. I mean, let's just look at the stats. We talked about this game already. Niners, man. Brock Purdy, 19 of 27, 314 yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions. Christian McCaffrey, sensational as always. 17 carries for 93 yards on the ground, 5.5 yards a carry with a rushing touchdown, of course. Debo Samuel, the wide receiver, also had 3 carries for 22 yards and a rushing touchdown himself. Debo Samuel, what a game he had. 4 receptions, 116 yards. That's an average of 29 yards per reception for 2 receiving touchdowns. George Kittle also added 4 receptions for 68 yards. Brandon Ayuk, 5 receptions, 46 yards and a touchdown. Juwan Jennings, 3 receptions, 44 yards and a touchdown. Christian McCaffrey, 3 receptions, 40 yards. So the Niners fired on all cylinders to improve to 9-3, while the Eagles fall to 10-2, only their second loss of the season. Jalen Hurts was neutralized. Well, not really. 26 of 45, 298 yards and a touchdown, a passing touchdown. Marcus Mariota also went 2 for 3 for 16 yards, I would assume in garbage time. Jalen Hurts rushed for 20 yards over 7 carries and, of course, had his patented rushing touchdown. DeAndre Swift, only 6 carries for 13 yards. Kenneth Gainwell, only 2 carries for 5 yards. And Boston Scott, only 1 carry for 2 yards. A.J. Brown, of course, was the leading receiver for the Eagles as he hauled in 8 receptions for 114 yards. While Devontae Smith was close behind him, he had 1 more reception with 9, 96 yards, and a receiving touchdown as well. Huge win for the Niners. Packers and the Chiefs. Mahomes, not the MVP this year, definitely not. 21 of 33, 210 yards, a touchdown and an interception. So not a bad game, but definitely not what we're used to seeing from Patrick Mahomes. Isaiah Pacheco was the Chiefs MVP, no doubt, as he had 18 carries for 110 yards. That's over 6 yards a carry, very nice, and a rushing touchdown as well. Mahomes added 26 rushing yards over 4 carries. Travis Kelce had 4 receptions, only 4 receptions, but 81 yards. That's over 20 yards per reception. Rashee Rice, 8 receptions for 64 yards, and that's pretty much it for the Chiefs. Jordan Love, as mentioned earlier, 25 of 36 for 267 passing yards and 3 touchdowns. A.J. Dillon, not much to write home about. He did have 18 carries for 73 yards, but that's only 4 yards a carry. Romeo Doubs had 4 receptions for 72 yards. Christian Watson was nearly identical as far as the yards go, with 1 less yards with 71. He had three more receptions, though, and 2 receiving touchdowns as well. And lastly, the Los Angeles Rams,
take care of the Cleveland Browns easily in the end at home, 36-19, to improve to 6-6 and cement themselves as a potential playoff contender, while the Browns fall to 7-5, and they're also likely to make the playoffs for now. Joe Flacco, the corpse of Joe Flacco, started for the Browns, and he was great. 23-44, 254 yards, 2 touchdowns, 1 interception. Considering he was on his couch last week, I mean, dude, this is very impressive from Flacco. Kareem Hunt had 12 rushes for 48 yards, nothing to write home about, 4 yards a carry. Moore led the way for the Browns receiving as he had 4 receptions for 83 yards. Bryant, 5 receptions, 49 yards and a touchdown. And Jerome Ford, the running back, had 3 receptions for 33 yards and a touchdown. Man, for the Rams, it was Puka Nacua doing it all. First off, Matthew Stafford, sensational game once again. 22 of 37, 279 yards, 3 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. Kyren Williams had a bit of a quieter game, but still, 21 carries, 88 yards. Nothing to write home about there, but he did have a rushing touchdown. Puka Nacua had the longest rush in the game. He had 2 rushes for 34 yards. Puka Nacua also had 4 receptions for 105 yards and a touchdown. Demarcus Robinson, seemingly out of nowhere, 4 receptions, 55 yards and a touchdown. Cooper Kupp finally had a big game, his first big game since week 6, as he caught 6 passes for 39 yards and a touchdown. Tyler Higbee, 2 receptions, 35 yards. Kyren Williams, 3 receptions, 24 yards. Ben Skowronek, 2 receptions, 12 yards. And lastly, Tutu Atwell, only 1 reception for 9 yards. So ladies and gentlemen, oh, actually, wait. Let's look at the NFL standings now real quick. Now that we covered all the scores from this week. In the AFC East, you got firmly at the top the Miami Dolphins at 9-3. The Buffalo Bills are trying to catch up to them at 6-6. And then at the bottom, you got the New York Jets at 4-8. And the New England Patriots, shockingly, at 2-10. AFC West, you got the Kansas City, it's pretty wide open, honestly. You got the Kansas City Chiefs on top at 8-4, but the Denver Broncos are on their ass at 6-6, and just behind them are at the bottom the Los Angeles Chargers and Las Vegas Raiders, both at 5-7. Any one of those four teams can win this division. AFC North, same thing, except the Bengals. Baltimore Ravens on top for now at 9-3, while the Steelers and Browns are 7-5, and the Bengals are at the bottom at 5-6. AFC South, three teams are in it. You got the Jaguars on top at 8-3, who will probably win, but you got the Indianapolis Colts and Houston Texans both on their ass at 7-5, and the Tennessee Titans unlikely to get their way to the top at 4-8 on the bottom. In the NFC, in the NFC East, it's a battle between the Philadelphia Eagles and Dallas Cowboys. The Eagles, for now, are 10-2 on top, while the Cowboys are right behind them at 9-3. And then at the bottom, you got the 4-8 New York Giants and 4-9 Washington Commanders. In the NFC West, the San Francisco 49ers are definitely going to win this division at 9-3. The Rams and Seahawks are both at 6-6. The Rams have the tiebreaker over the Seahawks as they beat them both in both matchups this year. And the Cardinals are the bottom feeders at 3-10. NFC North, the Detroit Lions are almost certainly going to win this division. They're at 9-3, while the Minnesota Vikings and Green Bay Packers are both 6-6. And the Chicago Bears are on the bottom at 4-8. And lastly, the NFC South, it is really up for grabs. Three teams can win it. For now, the Atlanta Falcons are in first place at 6-6. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers and New Orleans Saints are both 5-7. And then, of course, you got the number one overall pick, Carolina Panthers, at the bottom, the NFL worst record, 1-11. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is all we have for this episode of the Sean Sports Stop Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. This was episode number 420. I love you guys. Thanks for listening, and I'm out.